So we talked last week about sort of structure of the service, the things that we need to have. Why do we need to have an invocation and a call to worship? And why do we need to have so much prayer? And why do we need to have prayer of confession? And we ran out of time and we didn't get to why would we have a confession of faith? Why is that a useful thing to have? There are lots of discussions you could have in that area where wisdom more than law would come into play. So when we make choices to have prayer in the service, that doesn't automatically mean that we've made the choice to have corporate, responsive prayers, where we all pray the same thing out loud together. And so then there would be a discussion about, well, why would you do that? Or why wouldn't you do that? And what's the choice of wisdom in including that in your service? Or confessions of faith. When we read the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed and we all stand up and we say the same things and we're reading from a page, there are people, particularly guests, who will immediately see the cons of that approach. And some of us see the pros of that approach. And there's a good discussion there about what's the wisdom of doing it that way or not that way. Those are great discussions. We can't have all of those discussions in the course of this class, but I did want to give an example of that kind of discussion, because as we start to move into the case studies from our personal lives and from our family lives, what you will see is unlike, or at least less like, planting a church, where, as I think we've seen, the side of the board on what can we do, that is the law side of the board, is really long. Must, and can't. There's a lot of those. When we talked about how to have a church, lots of musts and can'ts, and then you get into wisdom later. What you find a lot of times on the decisions that we're making as individuals and as families is that the musts and can'ts, the law side of the board, is pretty short. It rules out a handful of obvious things like, you know, murdering your grandparents for their insurance money. But the wisdom side of the board has a lot more lawful choices. So then there's this massive spectrum of things that you are allowed to do, so to speak, but you don't want to fall into the trap of saying that because all of these things are lawful, all of them are equally wise or equally the right thing to do. You don't want to say just because I can do something, it means that I should do something. That's the difference between what can we sing and what should we sing. So when you go through the lists of law and you've eliminated your options down to just the lawful choices, the ones that it is not automatically sin to do, then you have to get into the discussion about wise and best, or sometimes not even best, sometimes just better. What seems, excuse me, under the circumstances to be the better of these options given everything else I know about the situation. And when you talk about church music, you are almost always in a world of better. There are, in the Trinity Hymnal, what, 700 some hymns, unique hymns? 735? There's a lot. More than 700. If there were, objectively, the four best songs to ever sing, we've evaluated all of the music in the Christian world, and these are the four best, period, no exceptions, what would we do? We would only sing those four. That's not what we do. And there's a reason that's not what we do. And it's because, depending on the circumstances, any of the 730 whatever in here, or even, God forbid, some songs that aren't in here, might be the better song for the given situation. So when we are picking music, we're making choices about what is the better music to pick in this particular case. We got to be careful about some errors of approach that people can make here. People being people like me, people like you. One is to start from the outset with subjective criteria and to basically say the only objective criteria is lawful or not. Juxtaposition in my head. Lawful or not, right? So, all right, we all agree that there are things that we cannot sing because the Bible says you cannot sing a hymn to Baltazar. All right, so let's take all of our hymns to false gods and say, nope, all right, not allowed to sing those. And then once we've ruled those out, then we say, well, everything else is subjective and a matter of opinion. That's buying into a postmodernistic type of relativism that we really shouldn't want any part of. So as we think through the rules of wisdom, we should ask ourselves, how subjective is this? Because if we have something that is genuinely subjective, then we've got to be really, really gracious and open-minded when people come to different conclusions on the basis of our subjective criteria than do we. Does that make sense? We always have to be gracious in terms of how we interact with people, but I don't have to be gracious with your conclusion if you do not accept that we have to pick lawful and unlawful, separate those out. Those are hard and fast. I might be wrong, and then you need to show me where I'm wrong, but I'm not wrong as a matter of opinion. I'm either right or I'm wrong when I say we have to sing our hymns to the triune God. That's objective. So what should we sing? How do we pick better songs? Well, there are some rules. But, well, let's call them rules of wisdom. The first rule for picking good music is that it must be true. Now, we gotta develop out true a little bit, right? Because you could sing lots of things that are true but aren't better for worship. So I could bring in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I could craft a song out of the Hawks box score from last night. And it would be true, but not particularly better than other things we could sing, right? So when we say true, we mean biblical. That is, it needs to be based on content from the Bible. It needs to be in accord with what the Bible teaches. But it's not enough to say it just needs to be from the Bible. It also needs to be, a friend of mine uses the words accurate and profound. It needs to be both accurate and profound. What does he mean? Well, he uses the example of a seminary professor who wrote a song called Bible, 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 Bible. Everybody reads the Bible, 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 Bible. Everybody, Bible, Bible, everybody, Bible. True? From the Bible? Useful? No. Right? You could also, so it, accurate, you also need profound. Jesus, 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 oh, Jesus, 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 oh, Jesus, Jesus, my Jesus, 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 my Jesus. Some of you have probably sung that tune before. I grew up on that. It's a classic. It's a favorite of mine, actually. Right? Again, is it true? Kind of depends because you don't really know what the words mean. Is it from the Bible? Yes. Is it profound? No. And don't misunderstand profound. Profound does not mean I need a seminary degree to understand it. Profound does not mean we are uncovering complicated theological depths. Sometimes we are. But profound means that it, in words that we understand and have meaning, it connects the supernatural God to the natural world that he has made. That's what's profound, is when you use words and ideas that bring those two together in our minds and in our hearts. So we need profound words. How could we worship God and love God with all of our mind when we're singing Jesus, 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 oh, Jesus, 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 oh, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus? Right? That's not an exercise in mental adoration for God. We're to worship Him in spirit and in truth, but we need truth to be robust. So do you see kind of the layers that need to be included within true? It's got to be from the Bible, it's got to be accurate, and it's got to be profound. Everybody good on those? That's our first rule. All right, our second rule. This will be fun. Ready for some fighting? It's got to be beautiful. B-E-A. Beautiful.
There's no beautiful
about you. Yeah. Morley wins the class. It's got to be beautiful. We struggle to put this on the board because as soon as we put it on the board, we think to ourselves, oh no, subjective criteria, boo. But I will make my next controversial statement. Beauty is not subjective. Beauty is objective. Something is beautiful or it is not beautiful. Your ability to discern whether it is beautiful or not beautiful, which is all messed up, like lots of other things in our minds that are messed up thanks to the fall, does not mean there is no objective criteria of beauty. A standard can exist that we struggle to define because of limitations with us and not with the standard. The often quoted Supreme Court opinion or statement regarding pornography comes to mind here, right? Define pornography in a sentence. And what did the justice say? I don't know. I know it when I see it. That's actually a very legitimate definition. You know it when you see it. Sometimes our judgment calls on beauty are wrong, and we need to be corrected. We need to be taught from others. We need God to remove blinders that we have that have certain preconceived notions about what beauty should or shouldn't be. Those notions are okay. We ought to have them. We ought to have some framework for defining beauty, but it might need some teaching. It might need some refining, just like a whole lot of other things in our mind that are just wrong and need to be fixed. But we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't say, no, beauty is entirely subjective because I'm really bad at determining what's beautiful, or more likely, beauty is subjective because what you are telling me is not beautiful is something I really like, and that proves it's subjective. No, it doesn't. It proves one of us is wrong. And I'm willing to grant... good point. At least one of us is wrong, and perhaps both, often likely both. So it needs to be beautiful. Now, in real practical terms, what does beauty mean for congregational singing? Again, I'm going to lean on a friend of mine who's a pastor who uses a phrase I like where he says, simple but not simplistic. It's got to be simple I don't want to get too technically musical here because I will show myself I'll show my ignorance quickly, and people in the room who know better will make fun of me, like when I get home. There are reasons that we use the tonal scales that we use in this church. There are reasons that we don't, for congregational singing, introduce Eastern types of music, introduce other types of music that may satisfy a definition of beauty, but they're not simple for us because they're not known to us. They're not the ways that our minds have musically been conditioned to function to this point in our lives. There needs to be a level of simplicity so that anyone in the congregation without musical training, by the third or the fourth stanza of a hymn, feels like they can participate in this really well. But not simplistic. Because if that's what we were going for, we would just sing the tune of Jesus Loves Me and change the words four times a morning, right? Because that's a simple tune. We all know it. We'd pick Amazing Grace. It's a simple tune. We all know it. Let's just change the words four times. But that choice wouldn't be better either, because There is a range of beauty. There are a whole lot of different ways that beauty is expressed in music. And if you only have one tune, you don't have many of those ways. And so we need more breadth, more width in what we're singing. It can't be so simplistic that we lose out on the beauty that comes from the variety, the breadth of the thing. That's exactly right.
And what about, and I'm wondering about a potentially slippery slope here. There's plenty of evidence, for example, that exposure to an appreciation of classical music is diminishing.
Right.
So that in a century, for example, what we regard as simple and familiar, everyone knows.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the style of music reflected in 18th and 19th century hymnody is immediately familiar to children today. I'm suggesting that a scale involving the keys on that piano and pretty common chord progressions, 1-4-5, 1-2, minor 6-5, like those things are exactly what they're still playing on the radio in this country. The way that those notes and chords function is still very much in the cultural consciousness of people in our country. If that were to change and we were to entirely switch the foundation of the music that we sing, then yes, the definition of simple in this country could change. And to your first point, yes, what's simple for us may not be simple for somebody on an entirely different musical scale. And you run into that even within the same congregation. What's simple for the congregation is not necessarily what's simple for the choir. And mostly vice versa, right? So you could have a song, excuse me, you could have a song that it is entirely appropriate for the choir to sing that it would never be appropriate for the congregation to sing. Is that fair? So when it gets into that level of standard, absolutely. There is the subjectivity, there is the judgment of appropriateness within that. There's also, and this is kind of a crossover, I'm going to use the word singable, which relates to this simple. It can't be so fast, it can't be sung. It can't be so slow, it can't be sung. It can't be so high, it can't be sung. It can't be so low, it can't be sung. Now, you know, I think the Pareto rule Pareto principle is going to be big here, 80-20, right? Most of the songs you're picking are going to fit in the wheelhouse for 80% of the people, and then there's outliers. But it is something to keep in mind. A subset of this is, think of the way I wrote this, consistent. And I'm going to put the word match. Here's what I mean by this. So it's a very popular thing right now, has been for a decade or so, to take the words of a lot of these hymns and to fit them into more modern tunes. That is neither a good nor a bad thing. Whether or not that was a good or bad thing has to be looked at both for the context of the song and for the context in which it's going to be sung, right? So you are pastoring a church like Westminster. No, let's pick another church in another land far, far away. You're pastoring a church with a lot of history and a lot of heritage and a lot of people in the pews who have been there for a long time. And yeah, there's a lot of new people, but there's a lot of people who've been there for a long time. And you make the executive decision that you're going to update the tune to A Mighty Fortress Is Our God because it needs a more modern, more relevant tune, and you're going to change it, and they're going to learn this new tune, and they're going to like it. You're dumb. You're dumb. Okay? You don't rip away the history, the familiarity, the connectedness of that just for the sake of novelty. Now, you're in a congregation of people who think this book is archaic, old-fashioned, a sign of probably the ancient Egyptians having once been present in your congregation. They don't know any of these songs. They don't know any of these words. They don't like anything having to do with it. And you find or you create an arrangement of an older hymn to a newer tune that is immediately appealing to this crowd and that enables them to sing something they otherwise would not have been enabled to sing. You're smart. You made a good choice. You did exactly the same thing as the person I just called dumb. You just did it with different people. Okay? But one of the things that matters a lot when you're deciding whether this old words, new tune thing is smart or dumb is the consistent match between the words and the tune. So a lot of you guys are probably familiar with Indelible Grace that does this and has lots of CDs doing this and kind of the RUF campus ministry movement is tangentially connected to this. And so they've done this a lot. They've taken a lot of hymns from the Trinity Hymnal, and they've replaced the tunes with modern tunes. Some tunes that were only 40 or 50 years old got replaced with modern tunes, but that's okay. When I listen to those CDs, and I do, and I really like some of the arrangements, I really dislike some of the other arrangements. And the thing that gets the most visceral reaction out of me the most quickly is when they violate this principle. The church's one foundation. What is that song about? Not a trick question, David?
It's about the establishment that Christ is the husband of the church, is the leader of the church, and we are the bride of Christ.
Christ, the rock of the church. The cornerstone, the foundation. How do you guys, if you needed to describe how you want the foundation of your house to be in a song, what would be the tenor of that song? What would be the tone of it? Well, I hope it would be pretty strong, right? The church is one foundation. That's what that's supposed to be. It is strength. When Indelible Grace updated that song, what did they do with it? It's the softest song on the CD. I am pretty sure it is a, you know, recovered pot smoker, hippie surfer with his guitar singing about the church's one foundation. Is Jesus Christ the Lord? No! You messed it up. You did it wrong. Well, what did you do wrong? Was it that you put a modern tune to old words? No. It's that the way we're singing, the tone of the song, isn't consistent with the words of the song at all. And just so you know, it works the opposite way too. You can't take a psalm of lament. You can't take a psalm where the Christian is crying out, God, where are you? My enemies are surrounding. I feel like my prayers bounce off the ceiling. God, where are you? You can't take that and sing it to a circus tune. Which, incidentally, the ARP Psalter has done that on a couple of songs. You got to have this match. You guys be glad you don't know that. The new ARP Psalter is good. The old ARP Psalter had some circus tunes. I mean that quite sincerely. There's got to be that match.
RUF also did that with Psalm 130, From the Depths of Love. That's the fastest song. You can like it, but it doesn't match. From the depths of love.
Any class where I can get Stephen to break into song is a win. So Morley, you win and I win. And then, again, within the category of singable, part of the challenge that many more modern Christian songs have is they're great songs for an individual or a very small ensemble to sing. And then they're applied to congregational singing. And this really took off in the 80s with the takeoff of Christian radio, and where radio DJs in cooperation with particular mega music conglomerates would determine what songs got sung in church. And people would hear it on the radio, and it'd be, oh, this is a great song. We should do this in our church. And somebody would bring that into a worship team environment, and they'd teach a worship team, and a worship team can learn it when they have an hour to practice it on a Wednesday night. It's a great song. We should sing it in church. And then you get in front of a congregation of X hundred many people, and X hundred many people stand there and pat their thighs and nod their heads while you guys sing the song for them, because it is not made for X hundred many people to sing at once. The better music is music that is conducive to congregational singing. Not solo singing, not small ensemble singing, congregational singing. Because we talked weeks ago about worship being a corporate activity. It is an act of the body, of the bride of Christ. And it's not an individual exercise in showing other people how well I can worship. Now, again, this is a great example of a principle that's true and a pendulum swing that causes people to take other positions that I'm not advocating for. So somebody could hear what I just said and say, oh, well, then therefore, the only singing that happens in congregational worship should be congregational singing, and we should not have choirs, and we should never have soloists because of what you just said. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying when you pick music for the purpose of congregational singing, your music ought to be singable by congregations. Is that clear, the distinction there? Just like when we pray, our prayers should not only be listening to other individuals pray. Our prayers should not only be corporate prayers that we all read off of a page together, but that there's value in both. And so for this particular prayer, as I'm planning out a service, which is the better choice, not just this particular prayer, this particular prayer in this particular service for this particular congregation. And the same thing is true on hymns, right? You could take hymns, think about an example from experience. Boy, what rabbit trails this will be. Yeah. Why do we use organs in church? But why the organ? We're not the only ones. Why are organs in church? Why'd they put it there in the first place? They are beautiful.
Because
it's an instrument that has the ability to support congregational singing. Aha!
It's not a one-trick pony.
Yeah. Ah! That's right.
Amen.
Hey, if Bach told me to do it, I'd do it. These are all great answers. We have organs in churches because where else, and there are several reasons, this is not the only reason. Reason number one, where else can you find an instrument that can be played by one musician that can support a congregational size of hundreds and thousands? Have you ever tried to sing in a church that just has one of these? This is my favorite instrument. This is what I love this. This is the best ever. You ever tried to sing in a church of hundreds with just one of these? With thousands of just one of these? If the room wasn't built for it, it's not going to work real well. You know what would be great to support congregational singing? An orchestra. Let's get us one of those. Wouldn't it be nice if on some songs you could have, you know, really deep and rich tones coming out, and on other songs you could have like woodwinds, and on others you could have brass and even kind of a percussive sound? Wouldn't it be great if there was one instrument that could capture all of those sounds? Oh, there is. It's the organ.
I thought you were
going to
say the synthesizer.
Yes. Not those sounds. Please not those sounds.
Yeah.
So this is why we like to assume. We all have myopic, self-indulgent views. And so we say, well, the reasons that we have organs are because the people who built the church wanted an organ because it was their favorite kind of music, and now we're stuck with it because we have it. And the only reason you people use an organ today is because your dad used an organ, and your dad's dad used an organ, and his mom used an organ. Right? That's the way we think these choices get made. But then you learn something about organs, and you figure out, oh, there's a reason why this organ is a better choice, given all of the other conditions, than the other choices that were available. In my previous congregation, we had an organ and we had a piano, and occasionally we would use both at the same time. We were a much smaller congregation. But we figured out something, a way to use that to our advantage over time. See, my preference, you may or may not know, I like loud. So especially in hymns, I like loud. I like A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. I like The Church's One Foundation. I like Holy, Holy, Holy. I want to hear that drone pipe rumble the seat around me. I love it. And the hymns that emphasize the majesty of God, what we call the transcendence of God, that God is other than us, right? He's not like us. He is so different than us. The hymns that emphasize that tend to be those loud kind of hymns. And they tend to be the type of hymns that we sing a lot in morning worship. That's just a tendency. But we found, you know what, we at our congregation were able to have evening service. And we realized there's a great way here to show our people how some of these choices can work. In the evening service, in the morning service, the sun is going up. The day is beginning. The majesty of the earth is being uncovered as the sun takes over, right? This sense of the beginning. Evening worship has the opposite sense. The sun is going down. The temperature is going down. You are getting sleepy. These are things that happen in evening worship. So we said, let's use this to our advantage and let's make choices that show people how some of the lawful and unlawful choices, or I'm sorry, some of the lawful choices that are more or less wise can change. Morning service. We use the organ. We sing hymns that emphasize the transcendence of God. I stood in a pulpit and wore a black robe. There was a real sense of transcendence. God is not like us in the choices that we made in morning worship. Very much on purpose. Evening worship, we made the opposite choices. I preach from the pulpit, but without a robe. We used the piano instead of the organ. We sang hymns that reflected the immanence of God. God is with us more than the transcendence. God is not like us. That's a way where you have to stick to these things, right? We couldn't suddenly introduce music that wasn't true because we just wanted to give people a breather from the truth. We couldn't introduce music that wasn't singable because we had this really amazing rock band in our church and we wanted to give them a chance to jam. But we could show people that these choices were made in good faith. And we didn't pick an organ and we didn't pick a black robe and we didn't pick A Mighty Fortress as our God just because that was our preference. We picked them because we thought it was better, given the conditions and the responsibilities of worship. And if those conditions change, it's nighttime, not daytime. We've emphasized the transcendence of God already today, so we're not at risk of forgetting it. So now the conditions have changed. we can make different choices. And those be wise choices given the situation. So you see how when we're picking music, all of this stuff can change week to week, congregation to congregation, almost moment to moment in these judgment calls. When Aaron picks out the hymns for a Sunday service, he's not just working from a list of these are the 730-something hymns that are approved for congregational singing. He is pouring over that list for what are the best ones for us to sing today. And sometimes you come to one and you say, wow, just on the basis of the words, this is the one we ought to sing. Oh, but it's a tune the congregation doesn't know. And the first hymn I picked is a tune the congregation doesn't know. And it's okay to learn new tunes. We should. But when you do two of those in the same service, people start to get discouraged because there's no familiarity. They don't feel like their full participation is there. So even though I really want us to learn this hymn, and I think these words would be perfect for this week, I can't do it now. It wouldn't be best. Have you ever imagined that is the process of picking hymns? Most people haven't. And I'll say it because I don't do it now, and so it's a reflection on him. It took me hours every week to pick four hymns because of that. What am I preaching about? It's easy to say, well, here's what I'm preaching about, and that's the main point of the sermon, so we're going to sing a hymn about that. But what am I preaching about that's a minor point of the sermon that I wish I had time to say more about, but I don't, and I know it's going to resonate with some people, and they wish I had said more about it. What is the hymn we could sing that fills in that void in my sermon? That's the kind of choices you make in terms of what's better. Why this book? There are lots and lots and lots of places we could go to get music that satisfies the criteria of lawful. We've already said that you're making choices about better and not about right and wrong. There's lots of other places you could go to get music that would be perfectly acceptable. Why are 99% of the songs that we sing in this church out of this book? Say more about that. Did everybody catch that? That in the Trinity hymnal, just like with the Westminster Confession, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We are not saying that these are the only 700-something acceptable songs. But we are saying every one of these 700-something songs is acceptable. And given the limitations of a human's time and ability to pick out songs every week, this makes that manageable. There's something else that this does that's more pragmatic. It's singable. You have a congregation of mostly, that's right. There are a few in here. There are a few in here. Hey, I will raise my hand and say with those, there are a few in here that you wonder how. Somebody on the committee had some pictures of somebody else on the committee, and this was the song they wanted in there. I don't know how that works. There's a few in here anyway. Singable insofar as we have hundreds of people in our congregation. You have people all across the spectrum of how long you've been in the church and what songs you know and what songs you don't know. But you know what you know for sure? You know how to turn to page 271 and find the words of the music. And what I have found is having the words isn't good enough. You need the music. I appreciate that our church, which I think, and I don't know, I wasn't here for this, so I'm totally speaking out of school, but by printing all of the hymns that we sing in the bulletin, it seems like they were trying to be conscious of people who didn't want to interact with hymnals very much. But when they made that move, a lot of churches that make that move just put the words in and don't put the music. That isn't so good. Even people who don't read music, my friend Steve May, who was here yesterday to talk with the men at the brunch, Steve doesn't read music. And I used to ask Steve what he's doing. I would watch his eyes. And he said, well, no, I don't read music, but I can tell when a note goes up and when a note goes down. You know, and Steve kind of takes the drone pipe approach to sing, that pipe on the organ that doesn't really have a note. It just fills out richness. Feels like that's his job in congregational singing. It's not so much about notes as richness. And like in an organ, hey, like in an organ, it's completely necessary in a congregation. You'd be surprised. People, except for the people standing next to you who love you and will be gracious to you, other people won't know that you're tone deaf. It just adds warmth and richness. And so you should sing, even if you say, I'm one of those people who can't carry a tune. See, told you the rabbit trails. You did this to me. The music, even for people who can't read music, helps them because you can see what goes up and what goes down, and you can get a sense of pretty quickly. You might never learn to read music, but you're going to learn pretty quickly the difference between whole notes and quarter notes in terms of how long. You might not know it's called a quarter note. But hey, when I see this black one filled in, I got to move off that one pretty quick. And when there's this one that's this open circle, I'm going to stay there for a while. Right? You start to figure those things out. So we have this because it's an easy way for everybody to be on level footing when it comes to the words and the music on the things that we're going to sing. It prevents having to make 400 copies of every song we're going to sing every week. It prevents all kinds of just practical challenges that are solved by the fact of, you know what, we've got this book. We know the songs in it are mostly good and singable, and they're in front of everybody in the congregation every week. And, oh, God forbid, you take one home, and you look at some of these words during the week. And imagine if you went to a church where you had access, say, on Wednesday or Thursday to find out what songs were going to be sung that Sunday, and you looked at them, and when you have young children, I don't do this because I'm terrible and I reprimand myself all the time for not doing this. Teach those songs to your children during the week, right? Get them ready. These are not hard. The first verse, right? You could teach a kid the first verse. And all of a sudden, you've drawn that child into the life of the congregation in a way that is something more than just you stand there and be still and be quiet and look happy because you love Jesus, right? It's a hard thing to ask of a kid. It's a hard thing to ask of an adult. So there are lots of advantages to having this. It's not, oh, it's what we've always used. There's something more to it than that. It's a choice made out of wisdom. And when, as occasionally happens, Aaron feels that there is an advantage to going outside of this book, and that's the choice of wisdom, then you do that too. You don't feel bound. You don't feel constrained to do something that is less wise because of some pragmatic reality. You factor the pragmatic realities in. What's the burden that this creates for other people? You think about those things, but now you're making judgment calls about wisdom. So, true, beautiful, singable, and whether or not they match, with very few exceptions, these are objective that we can know the difference between. But when you take two songs that satisfy the criteria and you say, which one should we have chosen this morning? That's a judgment call. That's exactly the kinds of judgments that we're talking about in this class. And we have to allow that two people who love the Lord and want to worship God faithfully and want to serve the congregation would come to a different conclusion. This is also true with what the choir sings. Sometimes you sit and listen to the choir, and I mean this in a very individual level, not a collective level. Sometimes, as an individual, you sit and you listen to the choir, and you say, that song fed my soul. Oh! Rich and beautiful. I am so thankful. And I want you to know that seven people over from you is a guy sitting there going, who picked this song? That's the reality of large groups of people. And so we have to be gracious and accept that People can look at the same criteria. What you can't do is say that song shouldn't have been sung, can't have been sung. Well, be ready to defend that it doesn't meet an objective standard, not just the, well, there's way better songs and blah, blah, blah. Yep. I think this is really important and a really good transitional lesson as we get ready to move into individual and family decisions. There are two things that happen a whole lot when we look at other people's decisions that I wanted this morning to make us very conscious of and to start to think about. The first thing is, for the people that we like, we are often inclined to pretend that objective things are not objective. We are inclined to look at choices people make, and we know, in our so-called heart of hearts, we know that that was not lawful. We know that that was actually not beautiful. But I'm afraid of a postmodern culture telling me that I am closed-minded and bigoted if I were to actually speak up and say no. And so we keep our mouths shut. Or I really like somebody, and that somebody thinks that it's beautiful, but they're wrong. And I don't have the courage to say to them, help me see what you were seeing here. Let's talk about that. Or the consistent match, right? Because we have a sense of that even from today's conversation. Well, no, they don't match, but I like such and such. Why? Let's wrestle through that. Let's figure it out. And is there a way to get the outcome, the feeling, the sentiment, the response that you're looking for in a way that has that match, in a way that's actually better? So the first thing is we negotiate away objectives as if they are subjectives. The second thing that we do in these decisions, and we're going to see this, I think, a lot, or at least you're going to feel it internally if you don't say it out loud over the next few weeks, is that once we get to our list where everything is lawful, and now we're just talking about wisdom, when somebody picks a different wise choice than what we wouldn't have picked, we want to say that their choice wasn't just unwise, that it was wrong. We question people's motives. We question their faithfulness. We question their commitment to godliness because they made a different choice than we made or than we would have made even if we were in their shoes. We're not talking about lawful and not. That's legitimate disagreement. And we're not even talking about in the terms of giving someone counsel, in my opinion, in my experience, in my estimation, if I were you, I would do this and not that. And here's why. That's okay. But when they pick that and not this, how do we act? Most often we act like they've sinned or they're dumb. Right? That is the way we most often act. When people make choices that are different than ours, we do it for self-justification because it makes us feel better about the own choices that we made. But we're doing it as if they've done something objectively wrong. I don't like this song, therefore it was objectively wrong to choose it. And that's exactly what we get accused of. And we want to say, no, we have all these great rules and we have this criteria and we have, we got our stuff together. We do if we're making these kinds of choices. But when all the criteria are satisfied, you've talked about the type of congregation, you've talked about the resources that are available at your disposal, you've talked about the theme of the service, and somebody just picks a different song than you would pick, you don't get to come back and say, oh no, I should have included that in the sinful category after all. I just didn't think anybody in their right mind would choose it. It's a rhetorical trick. You hear this on TV all the time if you watch the talking heads on the news channels. They say things like, no reasonable person would. No rational person would. And what that means is they're taking something that plenty of rational people would do. but that they don't want done. And if they throw it in this category, then they feel like they don't have to defend it. Oh, surely no sane person would use a guitar in worship when there's an organ in the building. Oh, you just did this. You threw guitars over here. So now we got to come all the way back here and have a discussion about whether guitars are lawful, not lawful, or a question of wisdom. It's easy to do this theoretically with instruments in churches. This is going to matter a whole lot when we start talking about how much house is too much house. How do I educate my children? How do we spend our time as a family? When we talk about these things, there are going to be people at these tables that make different decisions than people at these tables, and the instinct is going to be, oh, no reasonable person would think that you could, wait, time out. Let's go back here. And if we needed to put it on the not lawful category, then let's do that. But once we move over here to wisdom, what's better, then we got to stop using the talking heads language, and we got to be fair, rational, Christ-honoring, committed, faithful people can make very, very different choices. Okay? Any questions about music? Bruce?
All right. I have to confess, just so I don't get stoned, I appreciate the music here, so I'm just going to play the devil's advocate. In my estimation, there's like two big polarities, right? Traditional music of either piano
right.
And then the alternative seems to be more hip modern rock band stuff.
Right?
But both of them, we've solved the amplification issue with the microphone.
Right.
So using those criteria, how would we evaluate the other side? Because you could still do beautiful stuff.
You can do beautiful, you can't do majestic. So, I mean, just real quick argument. Why a guitar shouldn't be your only or primary instrument in a church. A guitar is a percussion instrument. A guitar is created to fill in a narrow spectrum of musicality. It does a very good job at that. If you are singing a psalm of lament, there are certain types of songs that actually, given the opportunity, a guitar could do a more beautiful job. A specialist instrument could do a more beautiful job than a generalist instrument on that particular task. It doesn't have the breadth. Have you ever sung A Mighty Fortress Is Our God to a guitar? I have. Don't want to again. Right? Now, again, what do I have available to me? We're a church plant of 27 people. We have no fixed location. We have no pianist, right? There are all kinds of things where you could say, in this situation, that is the better choice. What's that? I should have mentioned you. The reasons that organs got brought in the church in the first place was that as congregations got louder, it was always a cappella singing, they couldn't stay on key, and they couldn't agree to one tempo. And you needed an instrument, not that would be louder than the people, but that would fill in the tonal scale below the people so that everybody could hear it, so that it would keep them on key and on tempo.
The word a cappella actually means like in the chapel.
See, that's why this guy's here.
Where they said no instrument.
Right. They had better acoustics.
Wow, look at, and so it really wasn't a participatory thing at all. You were just like, wow, look at that.
And you have to be careful of zero-sum arguments, right? Where somebody says, well, worship praise bands turn into concerts, and people don't get to worship, and the individuals get full of themselves. And they only have to say, well, I know one example where that's not true. And so everything you're saying is bogus. Well, that's a zero-sum game. What I'm saying is that model is much more likely to result in that outcome. And so it is wiser for me to avoid that model and use one that does not lend itself toward those particular outcomes. I can go 110 miles an hour on Georgia 400 every day, and it has all kinds of benefits for my life. But it has a tendency to lead to an outcome where my car gets impounded and I don't get to drive anymore. And so it is wiser for me to adopt a model that is less predisposed to that problematic outcome, even though lots of people drive 110 on Georgia 400 every day and don't get their cars impounded. You see, it's the problem with the model. And that, those are the kinds of nuanced discussions. And the reason the worship wars became all heat and no light is how nuanced these discussions are. Because you could throw caveats on every one of these, and you could make edge cases on every one of them. And I get it, man. Life is messy. But let's talk 80-20. 80% of the time, what's going to bring me the favorable outcome? Right? And that's where I get into, it is not ideal to have a small group of people in front of the church leading music for hundreds of people with songs that don't have music on a projector. Like, you could add all of these individual choices where you would say, there is absolutely nothing sinful about any particular of those choices. But you have used all of those choices to build a model that leads itself to these particular outcomes that I don't think is aligned with what the outcome of faithful worship is supposed to be. Does that help? Right. Yeah, they're not up there saying, oh, me, me, me. This is about me. Those are good guys. That was one of those guys. Well, judging's good, especially judging other Christians, is good. Jesus tells us to judge. He tells us to judge with right judgment. So when I'm judging a particular song that somebody picked, I have to be extremely gracious to all the things that I don't know. I wouldn't have picked this song because I don't know the 800 things that led you to decide that this was... When I'm making a choice about a church and submitting to a church's leadership and the worship directed by a church's pastor, I want to understand, either through direct conversation or through observing it, that they use a set of criteria like this one so that I know, hey, I don't agree with every judgment they make, but I agree they make judgments with right judgment. And that's what I'm looking for. A church makes an error, in my opinion, in a particular church discipline case, or an error in the color that they choose for the carpet of the sanctuary. These are episodes of bad judgment. But they're not necessarily episodes of judging with wrong judgment. And when I join a church, I just want to make sure that I'm joining a church of people who judge with right judgment. Doesn't mean they're infallible. Doesn't mean they're not going to make mistakes. Doesn't mean that they're going to do 4% of the things that I agree with. But that matches. Last one, and then we're done. Go ahead. Sure. History helps us see what the consequences of our actions are, right?
We've had this worship wars for, what, three generations now? What is the outcome?
Yeah, and you see the pendulum is crazy. It's crazy. The reaction to unbelief and the way the unbelief was expressed was in stiff, lifeless worship. Well, of course it's lifeless. You don't believe. So then the pendulum swung, and then it was, woo, crazy time worship. No more belief, but hey, at least we're smiling. And then the pendulum swings back, and now, oh, goodness, now it's prayer catacombs and smells and bells, and hey, let's pull in every ancient worship practice we could possibly find, and these are what's going to, because our parents' worship, it wasn't authentic. But this, walking through this maze silently for 13 hours while I meditate about myself, that's authenticity. You know what's missing is faith. We could have fixed the dead lifeless hymns if we had faith. So let's do that. Let's worship in spirit and in truth. Let's not make it about, you know, how different can I be from the things I saw wrong with my parents. So you're exactly right, the importance of history on that. Okay, I've gotten so far off. We're done. Next week we move on. Thank you.